The following podcast is broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
This is Tasman Report with news, feature interviews and voices shaping Aorere. I'm John Bullock and this is a production of the Tasman District Council. In the show this week, Mayor Tim King is in Parliament, the story about Goodwood and the feedback from the Golden Bay Community Board drop-in sessions. Wednesday, March 18, and Mayor Tim King was in front of the Environment Select Committee with Barry Johnson, Environmental Policy Manager, speaking to Tasman submission on the Natural Environment and Planning Bills.
Tasman District Council, here we go. Morning, team. Grant McCallum, I'm chairing the Select Committee this morning, the subcommittee. We've got 15 minutes with your time. Please take your submission as read. Feel free to highlight a few points, but love it if you leave some time for questions. It's all up to you. Cheers.
Good as gold. Thanks very much for the opportunity to speak. So I'm Tim King, the Mayor of Tasman. This is Barry Johnson, Manager of Planning. Highlights that generally we're supportive of the intent of the legislation around simplifying, around streamlining, around making more cost effective. Our concern is around some of the details and whether or not they actually enable that outcome or whether potentially they may work in somewhat contrary fashion. I've got a few points to make and then hopefully there'll be time for questions. Our first point is, as a unitary authority, we're concerned that there's a bit of a misalignment between the two bills. And for us, that potentially dismantles the integration we currently have, which is kind of contradictory to the local government reform objectives that are being discussed around the country, and also prevents us bundling consents in a way that applicants can have one process that covers all their consent requirements for any particular project or outcome. So that's a really key concern for us, and we think that potentially for unitary authorities that means it's a step backwards from what is already a fairly well integrated system and process to something not quite so. We have concerns about capability and capacity right across the sector, and that starts at central government with MFE all the way through the system, regional TAs, just the number of skilled people across the system that are going to be needed to implement the legislation. So that remains a big issue for us in terms of both cost and complexity and the financial risk of trying to compete for resources in order to play our part. We're concerned about the timeframe, particularly the potential for us to be out consulting, and particularly with spatial planning, prior to seeing national direction and limit setting. And again, the risk that provides while we're consulting with our community over our part of the process without knowing the certainty that comes through that national direction and limit setting. We have concerns around some of the concepts which are, vague by definition. So regulatory relief, and we'll touch more on this in a minute, and reasonable use, terms that seem likely to generate quite a bit of potential legal action over time as we try and sort out what they actually mean in terms of case law, because they're not particularly specific. While I guess most people will have a view of what reasonable use is, it probably varies quite a lot between people with different views on whatever the subject of that particular process is. We think that on the regulatory relief, there's a potential missed opportunity to create a much more positive conversation about how landowners may be, in effect, recognised for the contribution they make to public outcomes. We already, in many councils, I believe, do have a system of rates relief around QE2 covenanting. And our kind of view is perhaps if we can swap the conversation from being a council puts in some form of rule or restriction and then there's some form of contest between the landowner and the council over what that means and what compensation should be provided. If we flip it around and say, well, we'll identify some key values and they might be biodiversity, they might be natural landscape, they might be a range of things. If landowners use some form of voluntary protection that is in perpetuity, it could be to QE2 covenant, but it wouldn't necessarily have to be. As long as it's enduring and legal, then the council could consider their existing rates relief mechanisms to provide that recognition. And that, in our view, creates a positive conversation where landowners are taking, and many of these values only exist because landowners have protected them for the last 100 and 150 years. And it's not uncommon in our region to have landowners put significant chunks of their property into QE2 covenants, and then that's recognised via our existing rates relief mechanism, which does two things. It means we're not spending a staggering amount of money on the process of putting in protection. It's a positive and constructive conversation with landowners, not a kind of contestable negative legal one. And hopefully it still delivers the outcome that I guess everybody's looking for, which is protecting those core environmental values. The last point we'd like to make is around collaboration with our neighbours, Nelson City Council. And I understand there's a submission from Nelson City around and requiring a compulsory working together for spatial planning. We're certainly open to the idea of working collectively. We've done two future development strategies collectively under the Local Government Act, obviously not through the RMA or its replacement. But we're not convinced that making that mandatory is the right thing to do. We also are unclear exactly what working collaboratively means under the legislation. Does it result in a collaborative process that still ends up with two separate plans across regions, or more than two if there's multiple regions collaborating, or does it result in one single plan? So yeah, like I say, we've had constructive conversations with Nelson City. We're positively inclined towards working with them on spatial planning specifically, but we don't believe it needs to be made mandatory. So in terms of recommendations, timeframes just need consideration around the link between national direction and national direction and limit setting alongside our planning processes, providing the ability to a wider range of relief for landowners or property owners around regulations, impacts, hopefully a more positive and constructive one, provide more explicit fees, charges and cost recovery provisions, including single well-defined treaty clauses, combine the bills into one piece of legislation and retain the option to have a joint regional spatial plan, but not make it mandatory. Open for questions.
Yeah, good morning. Great. Thank you. Well, the first question we'll have up, Rachel. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim, for that. Really good points you're making there. I'm just interested in this last comment about not being mandatory to have to work with Nelson on the plans. We had your neighbour, Nick Smith, say that he thinks it should be combined, but he was very careful not to speak on Tasman's behalf. You'll be pleased to hear very sensibly. Sorry, I'm just wondering why it wouldn't be mandatory when that's happening around the rest of the country and, you know, people live and work in across the two districts.
Yeah, so I mean, our kind of view is twofold. One is making it mandatory. We've been through two FDS, as I said. We were concerned that quite a lot of the workload ended up falling on us. And if it's made mandatory, there's kind of no option. You just have, like, you kind of fall into the thing, you have to do it. If there's a conversation about it, that means we can, and I've had this conversation with my neighbouring mayor about ensuring that the costs are split evenly, the staff contribution is split evenly, etc. And also, whether it's spatial planning is relatively straightforward, like I say, but the FDS, we've done it collectively. We're one urban area on the MPS urban development anyway. But when you come to the next lot of plans, then we're very different regions. They're a small, you know, small city. We're a vast rural area. And so our concern was also that if it involves both steps of planning, it may well be that we do spatial planning collectively, but actually the subsequent plans around environment and land use may be done separately. So we just want to understand what the process is and still have the choice to go into it. Like I say, I personally think it's the right thing to do. I'm just not convinced it needs to be mandatory in the legislation.
Okay, because it would be for other areas, you know, like Otago, for instance, is very, Queenstown's very different from Dunedin. But the cost thing, if the legislation was clear around costs, would that make a difference to your thoughts around it being mandatory or not?
Yeah, I mean, if it specifies that it has to be that the way the cost is shared is 50-50 or 33-33 if it's three or whatever, that helps. But it's not just the cost. It's the actual the burden of a large rural area trying to do the consultation, do all the work, actually by definition is different. So
under control.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks for that, Tim. Lan.
Tēnā koutou. Thanks for your submission. I wanted to pick up on your very clear comments that there doesn't actually seem to be anything in the bill that actually, for example, maintains water quality where it might be significantly of a better quality than the environmental limits actually set. What are the risks for Tasman? Like, is this a race to the bottom? Why did you point that out?
Yeah, well, I think we are in the position where our existing water quality is very high by national comparisons. Us in the West Coast are probably two areas with really high water quality. So the risk is that if the limit is set below that, then there is the possibility, remote though it is likely to be, given we have good water quality because it's been maintained through all sorts of different resource management legislation over time. The risk is there's the opportunity for that to be degraded through some form of action, consent process, etc. So, I mean, we're just highlighting the fact that maintaining water quality where it's already really good is, for us, really important. And you don't want a perverse outcome baked into the legislation.
Thank you. And can I ask another question, Chair?
Yeah, far away. Yep.
Thank you. The other aspect that I wanted to ask about was what seems like this very high bar when you are actually setting your regional plans, and that's where you can't actually use regulatory rules unless the council is satisfied that voluntary measures, for example, will meet the essentially the actions that you're trying to achieve in your action plan. How does Tasman perceive that? Like, are you going to be able to do this sort of big assessment and mean that means you're satisfied that the voluntary measures won't meet the action plans and then you could put in regulatory rules? Can you help step us through what that would look like for you?
I mean, I guess this cuts across the conversation that we had and the point we made around regulatory relief. Is ultimately the best outcome and the most cost-efficient outcome is that people do the things we want them to do without rules and regulations. That's the ideal outcome. And in my experience, probably 85%+ of people do the right thing. And the regulatory kind of thing is there to capture the people who, for whatever reason, you know, choose not to do things the right way. So, look, I would like to think that if the legislation's clear enough and the tools are available for councils to satisfy themselves that certain things can be achieved voluntarily, that, you know, we don't need to have as heavy regulatory role as perhaps we have had in the past. But at the end of the day, I certainly firmly believe in our council's position is we've had a massive emphasis on working voluntarily, working with landowners. Probably our best example is our dairy shed compliance program, where, yes, there are background rules and regulations, but the education, information sharing and working with communities has actually provided us much better outcomes at much less cost.
And I have a follow-up question there, actually, just on the regulatory relief, because I suppose where the issue arises is where you get a situation whereby the council imposes an outstanding natural landscape or SNA rules, et cetera, right? And a landowner feels that actually that's going to significantly impact on the value of their property slash ability to earn an income. It's very easy. I applaud your approach, by the way. It's very easy for councils or whoever to say, well, this is what we want, but if they don't carry the cost, whereas if there's a cost involved, they'll actually say, is this important to the wider community? So important that they're prepared to help pay for it. That's the question. What's your thoughts?
I'm not disagreeing with that. I actually think we just need to flip the conversation. Like, if you look all around the world, there are a vast number of countries where having some form of protection over your land is seen as an increase in value. You go to the UK, try and buy inside a national park or an area of outstanding natural beauty, you will pay a premium to live there because of the protection. we've never managed to get our country to that space because we do always see it as a negative and a negative impact. And I just think if we can flip that whole conversation and landowners go, actually, there's a financial upside in terms of potentially rates relief or some other form of relief, and my property value is seen as more valuable, protected than not, then we all spend less money on legislation, regulation, rules, policies and plans, because actually landowners aren't contesting the need to protect. They're actually going, actually, we can see it and it's in our own hands. We've been given the opportunity to protect it. Council or government's role might be to identify the values and then say, here's a pathway for protection. It's in your hands. You can do it through this mechanism. QE2 is an example.
Yeah.
And then there is some relief. The backstop would be if you don't do any of those things and you just say, actually, we don't want to protect it at all, then there's always the regulatory backstop. But that should be the last cab off the rank, not the first, which is what it seems to be the currently.
Yeah, a point taken. Look, thank you. Look, unfortunately, we've met time, but thanks for your presentation this morning, team. Really appreciate it. It's made some great points and have a great day. Cheers.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Cheers.
That was Tim King speaking to the Council's written submission at Parliament's Environment Select Committee hearing on the Natural Environment and Planning Bills. You can read the submission on the Council's website. The link is in the show notes. Here's a thought for the moment. If you haven't already got your firewood for this winter, it's probably a good time to start thinking about it. And when purchasing wood, use a trusted source of seasoned firewood like our Good Wood suppliers. A link to them is in our show notes. It's sad but true, poor quality wood will not produce as much heat as dry wood. It will be smoky and clog your flue with creosote. And then come winter, you'll suddenly find that your cheap load of firewood is not that cost effective and also could be dangerous. It's also worth making sure that you get the right type of wood. Softwood, such as pine and Douglas fir, dry faster and are great for starting firewoods. Hardwoods like eucalyptus and manuka burn hotter, but they can take several years to dry. Avoid woods like old man pine, as it contains lots of resins and will create black smoke regardless of the burning conditions. And the resin will also block up your chimney and stop it from burning efficiently. So get on to those good wood suppliers. The link to them is in our show notes. The Golden Bay Community Board recently launched what will become ongoing community drop-in sessions to foster the community conversation between the community and the board. We asked Chair of the Golden Bay Community Board, Grant Knowles, for his thoughts from the initial sessions.
Community Board were actually out in the community, talking to the community, I think was the biggest sentiment, to be honest with you. The feedback we had, it wasn't just from the people that turned up, but it was also from feedback we had from people who couldn't make it. They were just very happy that we were bringing the community board to the community. And I didn't really, I hoped something like that might happen, but not to the extent it was. And so it's been very good feedback.
So what do you think the community board members took away from the meetings in terms of possible key priorities?
Yeah, I think the some of the priorities were to communicate or connect with Department of Conservation and have a hui with them at some point fairly soon and talk about some of the issues around that. Go back to roading, go back to rivers and talk to both to council about roading and rivers, especially roading. I think they were two of the main issues. So, you know, it's just a general, we didn't take any names, we didn't take any, we took basic notes, but we didn't, make it so that there was too much detail in it, you know, like this pothole there or that pothole there wasn't necessarily what we were kind of looking for, and we didn't really kind of take that one on board too much.
And in terms of the roading issue, did that centre more around recovery or are people talking about they want new roads?
Around maintenance and how often they're graded, how often they're looked after, that sort of thing, really. I asked the people who came, you know, what necessarily was really interesting, say in Pakawara or Bainam or Upper Takaka, those specific places. But also I asked them, you know, what about the whole overall district and what do you see as the future and stuff? And I think that actually was then it broadened the conversation out. And so when it came to roading, it kind of there was quite a bit of talk about the new bypass around Richmond. And you know, just so you know, it did actually there are things like that that came up. The fact that Takaka Hill, yes, they were quite, I think they were quite happy in that it was fixed way quicker than the last time. So, you know, in a way it was good that it took so long the first time, because any other time is going to be better, right?
I like it. Well, overall, I think what you did, you did six drop-in sessions, roughly, And so, I mean, there's sort of the role of honour goes Pakawara, Bainam, Onikaka, Golden Bay East, Takaka and Upper Takaka. In geographic terms, they all sound and they do look pretty close together. Get a sense of their difference?
Yeah, you're definitely East Takaka and Upper Takaka are quite self-sufficient. They like, nah, we don't really need you to come here, and we any of our issues, we'll pretty much just do it ourselves. That was their kind of attitude. Whereas Pakawara, I think a lot of them turned up for various reasons and had a list of ideas of what they wanted to see. Onikaka was a little bit sort of broad, and same with Takaka, they were sort of a bit more broad, they weren't so specific. I'd like to get to Pahara, and I'd like to talk to Mana Whenua Ki Mauhua as well, because that's another, those are two more groups that I really feel we need to engage in. So it hasn't finished. Yeah, every 6 weeks we intend to do it. So when we have a meeting, so our next meeting is on the 30th of March. 2 weeks after that, we'll have a drop-in session, probably in Takaka, and we'll do that on a constant basis. So it's every 2 weeks after every meeting. And if we're going to have one in Collingwood, we'll just do it 4 weeks before the Collingwood meeting. Because our meetings are on a six-weekly cycle, I think it will work really well.
Golden Bay Community Board Chair Grant Knowles sharing feedback from the recent community drop-in sessions. You have been listening to Tasman Report with news, feature interviews and voices shaping Aorere. I'm John Bullock and this show is a production of the Tasman District Council.
The podcast you just listened to was first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz.